wanted to talk a little bit this evening on the topic of leftovers. And no, I don't mean the leftovers from the meal. There's one kind of leftover. Well, that's not completely irrelevant though, if you think about what when we finish a meal, we finish eating, there's always something left over. Even if you're careful to eat every last rice grain, there's always a little bit of oil or something like that in your bowl or your plate to get washed out. It's solid food, it goes to the compost, otherwise it just gets washed, goes down the drain. For those of you who didn't know, the water that goes down the drain in the sinks here goes into the grey water system with the reeds you can see outside, and then that gets purified, gets put under the what will be our back lawn when we get round to it. So something happens when there's leftovers. We forget about it, we ignore it, but there's still something there. Something happens to it. It doesn't just disappear because we stop paying attention to it. The word for leftovers in Pali is sesa, and Sanskrit is shesha. It actually has a very powerful and very important role to play in Hindu mythology. I'm sure you've probably seen in the iconography of Hinduism, they have like the cosmic naga or snake or dragon, which has 1,000 heads and which lies coiled in the ocean of the cosmos and underlies the world. And that when the universe disappears, then it gets drawn back into this great serpent. And when the universe coils out again in the next eon, it coils out again from this serpent. And the name of that serpent is Sesa, or Shesha, in Sanskrit. Felt to be an incarnation of Vishnu. Sometimes called Ananta Shesa, the infinite leftovers, literally. So even, it's not just at the mealtime when you've got something that's left over, but even when the world ends, not just the earth ending, not just a puny little nuclear holocaust or something like that, or a kind of pathetic little, you know, zombie apocalypse or something like that, but we're talking complete collapse of the entire universe, everything sucked into a little spot, laws of physics gone, everything disappeared. Even then, there's still a sesa. There's still something left over. A potential, if you like. And whether it's in the Hindu or Buddhist mythology of the cycles of the world eons and so on, or in the modern cosmology and the idea of the Big Bang and the Big Crunch and so on, and this idea that at the end of the universe, everything finishes. Everything's gone. But there's something left. Something left over. I don't know if you've read in the Suttimagga, it has very vivid descriptions of what happens at the end of the eon according to the traditional understanding. And one of the things that happened is that there are certain like prophets, I can't remember who they are now, I think they're one of the realms of gods or something like that, and they like put on ashes and sackcloth and they go around proclaiming the end is nigh, the end is nigh. It's a bit like, you know, now, really, isn't it? And we go around proclaiming the end of the world, except the difference is that the world really is about to end. That's the slight difference there. And everything disappears. Everything that you've ever liked or loved or wanted or been, it's gone, it's crushed. It's disappeared, whether you like it or not, whether you want it or not. Everything is gone. This is impermanence on a massive scale. The atoms themselves are destroyed. And when we start to think like this and start to think in a cosmological way, we begin to realize how puny our existence is. When you look out at the stars at night time, you look into the cosmos, you see how many thousands, how many millions of stars, and you know, even here in Bundanoon, on the high ground with thin, clear air, on a brilliant, cold, clear night with no moon, and you can see so many stars, it looks just so amazing. Even then, the amount of stars you can see is only a tiny, tiny, negligible fraction of the amount of stars that really exist. And they just keep on going on and on and on. And a few of the little stars that you can see, a few of the dimmest and tiniest little stars that you can see are not stars at all, but galaxies. And they're actually whole other galaxies filled with billions and billions and billions of other stars. And those galaxies we can see are only a tiny fraction of the amount of galaxies that there are in the world. And on and on and on it goes. Is it infinite, like the Ananta says, the infinite leftovers? Well, we don't really know. But it sure goes on for a long way. So this is very destabilizing perception. That's why it's quite traumatic to move from a perception of the world in the West to have this perception of the world that the world's created for humanity and everything's built around us. Whereas in Asian religious traditions for thousands of years they had this idea of countless worlds with countless living beings on them. And they're just one little speck. So you can, it's very kind of disturbing and very, very challenging to think of how thin, you know, we think of this world, this lump of rock that we live on, we call the earth, and we think of it as the earth is big, and of course in our own experience the earth is huge, but in the context of the cosmos the earth is just tiny. It's hardly even worth noticing. And all the things that we think are valuable about the earth, almost everything that we think of is valuable on the earth is just sandwiched on this tiny, tiny little skin between the rock and the sky. Just a few meters, really. Okay, you've got planes that are flying a bit higher than that and some satellites a bit higher than that. And some mines that go down a bit further, but for the most part, 99% of everything that in reality we actually live in and care about and hold dear is actually found just in a few meters between the surface of the earth and a little bit up in the sky, up to where the birds are flying or the treetops. That's where our lives are lived. It's like, it's so thin on the earth, it's like a skin of mold. That's what it's like. It's so insubstantial. And that incredibly thin layer of breathable air that we have protecting us from the vast abyss and chasm of space, the nothingness that goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And many of you know I used to be a great science fiction fan, and one of the problems with almost all science fiction in movies and things like that is that space is full of things. I don't know how many times you've seen in, you know, science fiction, like a, you know, spaceships flying through space and they accidentally run into another spaceship or they accidentally hit something. It doesn't happen. Space is too big. You keep going forever and ever and ever and you'll never hit anything. Unless you aim for it. There's just so much emptiness. so much nothing if you were able to stand outside our universe and say, what is that universe? Objectively, you know, what is that? If you were to stand in the position of God or something like that, outside looking in, you'd say, what is that? You'd say, it's a vacuum. There's nothing there. And if someone was to say, are you sure there's really nothing there? You'd say, look, absolutely nothing. And they say, are you really sure? And then you look really, really closely with a really powerful microscope. You say, oh, okay. No, there is something there. I can finally see it. But I could hardly notice it before because it's so insubstantial, all the stars and the galaxies and all of those things. This is how thin, how insubstantial our world is. And we sit here in this tiny little skin, this little layer of mold between the rock and the abyss of space. And we think that what we do has a meaning. We care about it. We care about our thoughts. We care about our deeds. We care about each other. This is the scale of human values and human concern. So I've said to some of you before, one of my favourite stories is the story of Zaphod Beeblebrox and the total vortex, what do they call the total perspective vortex, something like that. And this is, if you know Zaphod Beeblebrox from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he's a rock star with two heads, who was voted president of the universe and then ran off with the coolest spaceship in the universe, and so he was a wanted man. Anyway, they punished him one time. He was put in this punishment of going into a thing called the total perspective vortex, and this was the worst punishment you could possibly imagine. And everybody who came out of the total perspective vortex was completely insane forever, because what it did is it showed you a glimpse of your true place in the universe. You go into the total perspective vortex and you see reality unadorned and your place in it, and you go completely mad. It sounds remarkably like quite a lot of meditation experiences. I don't know if Douglas Adams was a meditator, but that's quite a lot like the meditation experiences. Of course, the joke was that Zaphod Beeblebrox went in there, and when he came out, he said, wow, that was really cool. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Because he really was the most important man in the universe, and the whole universe really did revolve around him, so he was fine. So this is one of the things that we do in meditation, is we do that. We deconstruct our perceptions. We deconstruct our world, which sits with us at the center of it, so that the whole world revolves around us, and everything we see everything as being constellated around our own identity and our own needs and wishes and desires and perceptions and so on. And we lose sight of the fact that that's just how we see things. It's not how things really are. So in the practice of meditation, we learn to gradually let go of these different perceptions, different ways of seeing things. Our perception grows and expands, and we can have these kinds of insights. We can have these moments where things just open up and seem clear to us. And it can be dangerous if it's not handled carefully. We have to be careful when we're doing insight that it doesn't go too deep too fast. We can lose contact. The reality is we do have to live in this layer of slime between the rock and the void. That's the only place we can live, and we have to adjust to that. And we, you know, as a practical matter, we can't go around a whole life being afraid that somehow the atmosphere is going to be stripped away and we're going to be exposed to the coldness of space. So there's always this tendency in spiritual practice, and certainly in Buddhism, when we developing the path and we practice, and we can hear the teachings about letting go and not self and emptiness and so on and so forth, and you know, we can understand, yes, this sort of strikes a chord with me, this resonates with me, it seems reasonable, it seems when I understand or I apply it in that way, it's helpful, it's useful. And so we can we put these things into place and we practice them, we like reform or adjust or change our own way of thinking and being in order to more closely reflect this perception of not self and of emptiness. And yet there's always something left over, isn't there? There's always that little something left over. And it's not until arahantship, until one becomes fully awakened, that there's nothing, there's no more sesa, no more leftovers. So even those who are, you know, practicing, even people here who have practiced and taken up the monastic life and let go of many things, then even we have our something left over. And even on that, those times when we're sitting in meditation and we experience a profound sense of letting go and peace in our meditation, even at those times, there's still something. There's still a something there. And even those very noble and holy beings who realize the various stages of the noble path, stream entry, the once returner, the non-returner, even those have something, a little something. Sesa, the Buddha called it an upadi sesa. The sesa that's left over from the beginning. Upadi sesa. That little something. That little kind of leak. So there's always this tendency when we're in our life, in our spiritual life, that we tend to, and not just a spiritual life, but it's a kind of a human tendency that we tend to sort of let go of one thing, and then we think, oh well, if I've let go of that, then that means I don't have to let go of the other now, because I've been virtuous, I've kind of let go of that, and then now I can kind of hold on to this one. And I saw a study of that some weeks ago, and that was actually confirmed that in practice, that when people make choices, I can't remember what the exact one was, but it was something like when you make a choice to eat, you know, if you choose to eat just a salad for lunch, then you're more likely to have dessert at dinner time. This kind of compensating. Or if people exercise or go to for a jog, then they're more likely to eat more. So there's always this kind of feeling, well, I've let go of one thing. So, well, it doesn't hurt if I hold on a little bit more to something else. And, of course, that's the reason why we don't have a steady and smooth progress in our spiritual life. Because every time we're letting go of something, we don't let go of it cleanly. It's not a sesa viraga nirodha, the remainderless fading away and ending of things. And then it says in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, a sesa viraga nirodha. Yeah, no sesa left. So we don't do that. We tend to let go some, but there's still something left over. We hold on some. We let go a bit and we hold on to another bit, because we get afraid. Yeah? This is the kind of one of the mechanisms of letting go. So I think it's important to understand this, and as with all of Buddhist psychology and the way that we approach things in our practice, we don't see that as a problem as such. We see that's just the nature of things, that's how things are, that's how the mind works. Once you recognize that that's how the mind works, then you can anticipate it, you can know that this is going to happen, you can understand it, and you can move beyond it. You let go of some, and you know, oh well, now I've let go. The next thing that's going to happen, the very next thing that's going to happen, is that there's going to be a fear and an attachment that's going to come in, it's going to grab onto something else. We know that. It's not because, you know, you're stupid or you're a bad person or anything like that. It's because that's how the mind works. We don't like to let go of too many things. We feel virtuous if we let go of something, so we hold on to something else. That's how it goes. So, you let go and you watch. Ah, what's going to happen next? What am I holding on to? Yeah. And when you watch, and you can see that, and you can see that mind coming in. Sometimes it might be, you know, something very trivial, you know, like in, say, at the mealtime, you might sort of, you know, take a small helping of one dish and think that you've done very well because you're not eating too much, but then you take twice as much of the next one because, oh well, I've already been virtuous, so why not reward myself, yeah? Kind of neglect, but it also happens on a much more subtle level, like you can see in your meditation. When your mind lets go and the mind becomes still, what creeps right in there is a sense of attachment or conceit with that state that you've reached. And that always happens. It's not something that happens to some people and doesn't happen to others, or happens on some occasions and doesn't happen on others. It happens all the time. Of course, it happened in different ways or to different degrees. But every time when the mind becomes still, or when we let go of something, oh, in the background there, something's creeping, something's going, oh, holding on to that. Staying for a while. And then, let go. Move on. So as long as we understand that, we know that this is going to happen. We know this is the nature of things, that there's something left over, there's a sesa there. Then it's not too much of a problem. That's just what we do, it's what we work with. And you can really feel that very strongly when you're doing, especially breath meditation, actually all meditations, but it becomes especially clear in breath meditation, where when you're paying attention to the breath and you feel a kind of a sense of almost kind of pressure or tightness around the breath if you're paying attention too hard, but then somehow there's a loosening and a letting go, a quietening, and the mind sort of comes in and stills with the breath. So it's like it kind of drops down a level, and the mind keeps on going. But then there's something else creeps in at that level. So maybe mind starts to wander, or it starts to get a bit tight or attached, or something else happens at that level. And you keep on going. But then eventually it'll drop down another level. And each level that the mind goes down, the attachment to the feeling of the breath becomes a little bit more, becomes more subtle, but also can become more powerful. Because the mind itself is becoming more powerful. And so even though, as our meditation goes on, even though everything's becoming more subtle, but at the same time it's becoming much more powerful, and we can see this pattern of grasping, these waves of attachment, and we can see these more and more clearly. And as we learn to recognize those waves of attachment, we can gradually can learn to let them go more and more and more. And that's what meditation is. Meditation is nothing more than that gradual letting go, on and on and on. letting go, letting go, letting go. Until finally, with the real letting go, is the 16th step of Anapanasati, Patinisagganupassi. Contemplating letting go. It's actually the same word as you find in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, yeah? As I recited at the beginning. Yotasa yeva tanhaya sesa viraga nirodho chago patinissago mutti analeo. So the remainderless fading away and cessation of that very same craving. Chago patinissago, the giving up, the letting go of it, the release of it, the non-attachment to it. So the patinissaga, letting go of it. Which is asesa, without any remnant. And that's actually the 16th stage of breath meditation, and of course is equivalent to arahantship, or full awakening, full enlightenment. So this is the stage that the Buddha called the anupadisesa nibbana. Yeah, it's nibbana, the state of nibbana that has no residue, nothing left over. Actually, that's technically, I'm getting my terminology. I'm using the terminology a little bit loosely here. Actually, technically, the sa-upadisesa, the nibbana with remainder, refers to the arahant during this life, even though they don't have a remnant of defilements, but they still have the five khandhas, which are just the leftovers, the sesa that stays just for this life, and the anupadisesa. Nibbana is the nibbana at the end of the life of an arahant, when there's not even that sesa left, not even just the five khandhas continuing from the force of karma in the past, but nothing at all. Of course, this is the scariest, most difficult and most challenging thing to understand and to accept in Buddhism, is this notion of nibbana. And when the Buddha first contemplated teaching the Dhamma, there were two things specifically which he caused him his reluctance to teach. And one was, he said, was dependent origination, which is, he said, was hard to see, hard to understand. And the second thing was Nibbana, which he said was very hard to understand, Sududdhasam, very hard to see. So the essential idea, the basic idea with Nibbana actually is quite simple. It's just that it's letting go without any holding on, without any sesa, without any remnant, without anything left over. Asesa viraga nirodho. That's very, very simply, that's what Nibbana is. And Buddha said it's this attachment, grasping, the craving, that's what leads to suffering. When we let go, the more we let go of the craving and attachment, the more we let go of suffering, and we let go of suffering. If we let go of attachment and grasping and craving completely, we let go of suffering completely. Asesa. Nothing left over. That's it. So that's the notion of Nibbana, or the concept of it, the idea of it, of course, is something which is quite challenging and quite controversial. People find it disturbing, nihilistic. But of course, that's the idea of Nibbana, that's not Nibbana itself. Nibbana itself is Shivam, is peaceful. And we get the courage to pursue this path towards this end of Nibbana. We have the courage from witnessing what happens when we let go. We witness in ourselves, when I let go, this is what happens. And we witness, when I attach to things, this is what happens. It gives rise to suffering. And we see that again and again and again and again, in coarse ways and in subtle ways. And each time we're reminding ourselves of that lesson, if we let go, it leads towards peace. More and more and more. And so if we can trust that process and trust that letting go, then we can trust that complete letting go without any cesa, without any leftovers, and that will lead to the ultimate peace, the perfect peace that we call Nibbana. So this is my talk for you this evening on leftovers. And I offer this for your contemplation. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Do you think that the reason that a lot of people turn to a religion with an afterlife is because they want their sesa to add up to something? Or to be a kind of reward?
Probably. Yeah, probably. Although, I think there's something to that, but I don't think it's a full explanation, because the afterlife is just as often depicted as something that's pretty scary. You know?
Yeah.
Just as an obvious example, if you look in fundamentalist Christianity, I mean, they often, you hear figures like, 400,000 or something souls are going to be saved and the rest are going to be condemned to hell. So your odds aren't actually all that good. So it's, hell's pretty scary. And Buddhism, you find similar ideas in Buddhism as well, that only a few make it up to the good places and a lot don't make it to less than good places. Certainly I think that there's something to that, this idea that there's some kind of meaning to our life. In an ultimate sense. I mean, of course, there's meaning to life in a limited sense. In a particular context, a life has meaning. But the problem is that when we move outside that context, that's when the challenges come.
Do you think that the obsession of the end of the world would have is from a conception of the sheer fragility of life in that situation?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think actually it's very healthy to think about the end of the world. Yeah, I mean, it's what you find it in the Buddhist scriptures quite a lot.
The end of the world makes all human endeavors ultimately pointless. How do we find the courage to care?
How do we find the courage to care?
Yeah, well,
bits of slime care about other bits of slime. That's our life. It might not mean anything from a cosmic perspective, but it means something to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is kind of. There's a kind of on a humanistic level, it still means something. So that's why you have to be careful with these kinds of thought experiments and ways of looking at things. It's a way of reflecting and a way of seeing things. But ultimately, there's nothing more true. This is the thing: is that the cosmos is there, right? But just because it's bigger, it doesn't mean it's more real or more true than what's happening here in this room. This is just as much a part of the cosmos as anything else.
And this letting go isn't giving up on yourself.
Well, it's giving up on yourself, but not necessarily giving up on yourself. Yes. Yeah.
Or well, giving up on things that matter to you, that you think are worthwhile.
But you said that we always compensate when we try to do something like that's too scary because that means that you can't really improve yourself volitionally because you're always going to sidetrack.
No, it's not an iron law, it's just a tendency. So you just kind of watch out for it. Yeah. You know, and it's not necessarily, the counterbalance isn't necessarily 100%. Right? So an example was when they introduced seatbelts. And it was introduced in the late 50s or early 60s, and they had a lot of people were dying in car crashes, and so they wanted to figure out how to keep people safe, so they consulted the manufacturers of egg cartons. Seriously, this is what they did, yeah. And they said, how do you stop the eggs from breaking? And they said, well, you stop them from rattling around. As long as they don't move too much, then they're okay. So they said, how do you stop people from moving? So they said, well, we'll give them a belt and we'll tie them in. So that's what they did. And they did all these studies to predict how many fatalities that this was going to improve. And by doing all these crash tests and things like that. So you do crash tests with dummies and you record the difference in the fatality rates. And so they projected that the fatality rates would drop. And when they introduced them, they found that the fatality rates dropped significantly, but not nearly as much as they thought they would. And the reason for that was because people felt safer. They had their seatbelt on, and so they didn't take so much care when they were driving. So it still helped, but it didn't help as much. Yeah. But that does raise other questions. For example, like about the efficacy of, for example, sprinkling holy water on cars in order to make them safer. Because in that case, it may have the positive effect of convincing somebody that they're safer when they're driving around and making them thus drive more dangerously, but without actually the actual safety improvement of having had holy water sprinkled on your car when you smash into a semi-trailer may not be that effective. So it might actually cause more accidents by doing that. But I don't know if anybody's actually studied it. The which one, sorry?
The
general
who shot himself.
Oh, right, yeah. His amulet, yeah. Yep. They certainly proved something.
But with the question of letting go and stuff, it's kind of like whack-a-mole, I think. You whack, the first mole comes, another pops up, you whack that one, another one comes up, and you just keep at it. But if you're whacking hard enough and often enough, they do stop coming up. Eventually you break the game.
Moles.
Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole. I'm not familiar with it, but I'm getting the idea.
It's a game where you put a hammer.
No animals were harmed in this example.
The actual game is like a square of lots of holes, and a virtual mole pop up, like a plastic.
Yeah.
And you try to hit it before it goes back down. When you hit that one, another one pops up, and you try to hit that before it goes back down. But if you hit it hard enough, you eventually break the game. You'll stop coming back up.
I suppose you don't have to use any force.
You mean for in letting go?
Yeah.
Or in whack-a-mole, in letting go? Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it's about being persistent and consistent, and not about being forceful.
With letting go, you let go, and then you sort of you're afraid, so that you sort of holding on to something else. It seems to me that the hardest part is actually recognizing where you're holding on, because you've got a lot, because you're deluded, basically. what's the relationship between the fear and the delusion? Or is it is but that seems to me to be the bigger problem, is the delusion rather than afraid of letting go.
Yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as you recognise something, then you can actually do something about it.
Well, if it's on a sort of a course level, then you usually recognise it first of all through behaviour patterns, and you can see your tendencies. But you know, when you're in meditation, then you can see it more just by seeing it directly. You know, you say, "Oh, that thought's coming up," or that attachment to that's coming up, and you just kind of catch it, and you can see it in the act.
I find things, particularly, you know, talking about the tension, you know, there's something that I'm holding on to, you know, and it's causing a lot of tension,
mm-hmm.
and it's very difficult
mm-hmm.
to find what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Very subtle. Well, it might
yeah.
not be subtle, it might
sure,
be very
yeah.
deluded.
Yeah, sure.
But it's often very, very difficult to see.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably like, you know, people are anorexic and they still think they're eating too much.
Right.
They're trying to, you know, let go of wanting to eat, but they're already so skinny that they can hardly be warm because they want it. You don't really know what you're supposed to be anymore. Or if you're really fat and you still think like, oh, you know, they should eat. You should have fat. I'm just saying, people still think I should eat less.
One of the sort of end of the world civilization things I like is the if you look at like pictures around Chernobyl, nowadays it's been abandoned and the forest is kind of reclaimed and
mm-hmm.
it's broken up with the concrete and stuff and the trees are growing and building.
Okay.
It's a very wonderful to see that.
Yeah.
It's just how all the stuff we build,
yeah.
so for instance maintain, and nature can just come and take it back over quite easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just have streams that we have to maintain this artificial state.
Yeah.